When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a growing network of people who believe the center of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ, and that learning to take love seriously is vital for how we practice discipleship, mission, and leadership. The Gravity Leadership Podcast explores, in practical ways, how to root our lives and our leadership in this love that holds all of us and everything together.
Good day, everyone. I'm here with Christy Penley.
Hey, hey.
And Ben Sternke.
Hello, hello.
Ben and I are wearing our black hoodies, and Christy is
traditional Friday.
Definitely, is that a
monk
that's a
outfit?
Blouse, right?
It's a dressy headphones. Shirt and my pink headphones.
Dressy yes. Shirt, pink headphones. Very different from Matt.
You guys
and
look
I's
like twins.
Monk attire.
Yeah.
I'm going to do a workout right after we record this.
Oh.
So that's why okay. I have my ratty black sweatshirt on.
Yeah,
so
Sporty Ben.
Sporty Ben.
Yeah. We are continuing our series here on things that we weren't trained to talk about in seminary.
I thought you were going to say things that make you go,
Just things.
Remember that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, when I graduated seminary 15 years ago, I mean, I spent a third of my time studying Greek and Hebrew. And I was told, If you just know the original languages, you'll be able to answer every question you'll find in pastoral ministry. And I have found that is not true.
It's not all in the Bible, Matt?
Well, there's a lot of things in the Bible. I love the Bible, but I finding things like, for instance, today we have Andrew Whited and Samuel Perry on to talk about their book on Christian nationalism. That wasn't covered.
Nope.
In homiletics.
No. We came up with that one after the Bible. After the canon was closed, we came up with that one.
But if you're a white pastor or a white churchgoer in America, you have probably encountered Christian nationalism, and you don't know what it is or how it happened or what we did or to do about it.
Yeah.
So anyway,
there's lots to think about there, a lot of pastors that I know, they have, and probably a lot of people listening to this podcast, they probably are uncomfortable with it, but are confused oftentimes by the fact that maybe so many of their other family members or other people that they go to church with aren't uncomfortable with it, that they actually think this is part of what it means to be a Christian in the USA, and that there's something wrong with you if you're not excited about Christian nationalism. So there's a lot of confusion out there, a lot of help needed, I think, for us to parse these things in our day and age.
Yeah. Is this a question for you where you live, Christy?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it's a question for everyone, in America, especially America. That with all that's happened and gone down in the last year. So, yeah, these guys are smart, and they know their stuff, and I felt like I learned just by listening to them and asking them questions. It's good.
Yeah, these guys are Christians, but they're also sociologists, so they take data and research and chart and track and make sense of data and trends. And so there's some surprising things they find in the data about Christian nationalism and maybe some less surprising things. So we probably should close our yappers. I'll speak for myself. I'm going to close my yapper, and we'll listen to Sam and Andrew. Yeah?
Sounds good.
All right. Well, gird up your ear holes. Hey, I'm joined on the Gravity Leadership Podcast by Christy Penley. Hey, how are you, CP?
I'm so good. I'm glad to be here.
You got two sick. You got two sick kids, though.
They are. They're downstairs on the couch. We did the COVID test, and we are crossing our fingers that it is negative.
Yeah. Well, here's what's amazing. When my kids are sick, I put them in front of the television. When your kids are sick, you're like, do some math homework. I'll be back in an hour.
I did. I'm that mom. What in the world?
Well, you're a rock star. You're awesome, CP. All right, we're joined today by Drs. Andrew Whited and Dr. Samuel Perry. They are both associate professors of sociology and religious studies. Samuel is at the University of Oklahoma, and Andrew is at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. Hey, guys, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Real quick, we're here because y'all wrote a book, Taking America Back for God. And that's what this podcast is about. We're trying to figure out how to do it. this is really relevant to our world today, especially for Christians who live in America. And the subtitle is Christian Nationalism in the United States. I want to hear about this book. But first, how did you guys meet and how did you decide to write this book together? Sam, maybe you could start and just tell us from your perspective.
Sure. I think Andrew and I had corresponded via email and just had some common interests years prior, before we ever decided to write a book. We'd been collaborating on other things, or at least thinking about other things to work on together. I think we were both studying religion and families. And we started playing around with some data. That's how a lot of our projects, our collaborative projects start, with just kind of digging into some data and seeing what's there. And we got a hold of some data and had these funny variables and measures that had to do with people's thoughts about the role religion has in the public square, whether or not Americans feel like the success of the United States is part of God's plan, or that or whether the federal government should declare the United States a Christian nation. And we thought, surely these variables or these measures are tied to some kind of a political conservative worldview or some kind of attitudes about race or gender or sexuality. And we found that once combined together, that they had this powerful influence on Americans' political attitudes and their behaviors. And we said, we got to dig into this further. And so I think it started with issues of sexuality, of Americans' attitudes towards maybe civil unions and same-sex marriage. And then we also got into issues of racial boundaries, interracial marriage, transracial adoption. And that was the one that was actually kind of interesting for us, and I think really propelled us to explore this further, because all of our questions that we have in these data sets that we've been exploring, they're ostensibly race neutral. They have nothing to do with race. They don't ask about race. They don't ask about like white people or black people. They just ask about religion in America. And yet it's one of the most powerful predictors of Americans' racial attitudes, their attitudes towards immigration, their attitudes towards Muslims, their attitudes towards African-Americans and policing, all of these things. And so we wanted to dig into that to find out why on earth would these seemingly race-neutral religious questions have such a powerful influence on Americans' racial attitudes. And that really is, we started to look into that with Trump, support for Trump, and support for all of the things that Trump has been about the last 4 or 5 years. And that got us going.
Yeah. Andrew, what was it for you? What was the data set that really captured your heart and made you want to write this book with Sam?
Yeah, Sam, I have the same memories. It was the Baylor Religion Survey, the 2007 wave. So that's where I went to grad school. So we had access to it pretty early on. And so Sam and I, we might have even worked on, I think our first paper together was with that data set, but using different questions. And just like he said, we looked at those six measures together, and our first paper was on attitudes towards civil unions and same-sex marriage. And then, like Sam said, we did a couple on race, and it was at that point Sam was like, man, I think we're tapping into something that is a little more powerful. It's not just kind of this, sometimes in our field you may have a measure of interest that explains one little thing, but it was at that point we were like, I think this is something bigger. And so as we started digging into it more, whatever, you know, you are interested in or anything having to do with how Americans see the world, there's very few that this doesn't help us understand. And so, yeah, we just started writing papers. And once we had, you know, 4 or 5 peer-reviewed articles on it, we were like, we really need to put this into a book and just put it all together in one place and write for a broader audience, not just for, you know, the 5 people in our subfield who might read it. But that this is really going to help explain something. And I think, you know, we're excited to continue to unpack this with you all and others where, you know, if you want to understand religion and how it relates to American life, you know, we can look at how often you attend church or what religious tradition you're a part of. And that tells us something. But what we find over and over and in our book is that how much you want to see Christianity, or at least this particular type of Christianity, privileged in the public sphere, that it should be kind of over and above other religious groups or traditions. That is something completely different than personal religiosity. And I think that's where it really gets interesting, is that we're not just talking about religious people. You're going to have religious people that reject Christian nationalism, and you're going to have religious people that accept it, and they look completely different. And that, I think, is what fascinates us endlessly. And we're just glad that other people are fascinated by it too.
Yeah, it's kind of hard not to be interested in it right now. I mean, we're recording this in the shadow of January 6th, where you know, maybe the enduring image that I'm thinking of as I'm talking to you guys right now is a man covered in face paint and animal hides with horns on his head, praying a prayer that I would have heard at a revival meeting, mixing in some shaman language. And a bunch of people that seem like they know how to pray, like at the charismatic evangelical churches I've been to, amening and Lord Jesusing him, and I'm watching this unfold, and I'm thinking, how did this happen? Because I was taught like beware of syncretism and watch out, right? Watch out for the gospel being polluted and diluted, and it was just so surreal. And so, you guys may be the only experts I know about this. So, Christy and I want to pick your brains just about maybe, first of all, defining Christian nationalism, and then maybe applying some of the things you learned to how do we make sense of what we're experiencing today? Yeah. So how would maybe Sam, what give us the quick and easy, what is Christian nationalism, and how did that definition emerge for you as you did your research?
Yeah, I think it really emerged inductively as we were trying to explore what exactly do we have here. I mean, I think even in our early studies where we were exploring this concept of Christian nationalism, we really didn't quite know what we were dealing with in trying to figure out the contours of this belief system. What do we call it? How is it operating? How does it function for people? I think at this point, I'm comfortable talking about Christian nationalism in two ways. One of them is something that drives people, in another way is something that people that it doesn't necessarily drive, they use and leverage for their own purposes. And so in some ways, Christian nationalism is this cultural framework, this ideology that idealizes and advocates a fusion of American civic life with a certain kind of Christianity. And I always put an asterisk by that word Christianity, because I don't mean assent to like Orthodox creeds or following Jesus as a disciple of Christ. I have that has almost nothing to do with it. I mean, a certain kind of Christianity as culture, right? Like Christianity as a dog whistle that means people like us. And so it's a fusion of that kind of Christianity with American civic life. And that can drive people, that can motivate people to see the world in a certain way of us versus them and good guys versus bad guys in a way that justifies all kinds of violence and extremism. In another sense, though, Christian nationalism also is a language. It provides kind of, or if you, a technical word would be a discourse, right? Like it's a set of linguistic tools, like that dog whistle phrase, right? Like it's something that I don't think Donald Trump is actually motivated by Christian nationalism, because I don't think he gives a crap. I don't think he really cares. Honestly, like I think, for Donald Trump, Christian nationalism is a language that he uses to leverage and to signal to certain people, I'm your guy, follow me, I got your back, we'll do this together. And so without being motivated by Christian nationalist ideology, he's able to leverage that set of linguistic tools to be able to rally people around him. And both were on display, and both have been on display. Both people who are motivated by this to do horrible things, and the people who are pulling the strings and using that kind of language to accomplish their political purposes.
Hmm. Yeah, Christy, as you listen to this, what are you thinking about? Because I know you've been a Christian much longer than I. You're much holier than I am. Like, what are you thinking about this from just like growing up, or even your experience now as a pastor at a church?
Yeah, well, you know, as you were talking, Sam, I had a question for you that, you know, this past summer when George Floyd died, my mentor basically looked at me, who's a black woman, 75 years old, and said, you're racist. And I cried, and she said, and I'm racist too. And there was a place there that it's in us. We have to be aware. We have to have eyes to see and be self-aware of where are we seeing this, like in our own lives, in our own families, in our own churches. And the same question here for Christian nationalism, where do we see it? Do we have, because a lot of times I think, I mean, I hear you talk and I'm like, oh, that's not me. And then I think, but where is it me? What language am I using? What terminology am I using? How am I communicating about whatever the thing is? And it's coming out sideways, either in my life or in our family or in our church. And I'm wondering, can you speak to that at all? Do you see that? Is that parallel correct?
Right. Sure. You know what? What I try to tell people when people ask me, people don't have surveys to distribute to their friends and ask them, where do you fall on our little Christian nationalism scale? I mean, it's just not, doesn't happen that way in conversation, nor should it. But when I try to help people understand what Christian nationalism looks like in the wild and how this has kind of infiltrated our conversations mm-hmm. and our churches, I usually hit on two things or try to help them see two things. If somebody is talking about Christianity, and it makes more sense as a culture than as a person, right? Mm-hmm. Like if my allegiance as a Christian seems like it's more to a culture, a set of principles or values or morals rather than a person, right? I don't care about introducing people to Jesus. I care about introducing them or converting them to my culture, my way mm-hmm. of thinking and doing things. And that's probably an indicator that there's a mixture of white middle class American individualism mixed up with Christianity, and that's really what I'm trying to shuttle into people's lives. The next indicator would be us versus them kind of thinking. When I start to look at people who are not Christians, not as an us for them. And I'm a Christian. I identify as a Christian and am active in my church, and I want to model the kind of priorities that I think Jesus would have modeled. He seems to be the kind of his orientation to people who didn't have a relationship with him was a me for you, my sacrifice for you, right? To love you and extend myself to serve you. If my orientation to the outside world, people who are not Christians and don't consider themselves, that is not me for you, but it's me against you, right? Like you secular atheist infidels who are trying to take what's mine. And I've got to wrestle that back. Otherwise, God loses. Then I think that's an indicator that I have somehow exchanged the Christianity of Jesus for some kind of American culture war Christianism, right? Like it's not Christianity; it's Christianism. It's some kind of Christian nationalism is what we call it. But I think does that help? I mean, it kind of, and you can see that all over,
of course,
our Christian culture, and that's I think that's kind of what we're trying to identify.
Yeah. Andrew, if you could speak to one of the places that is really scary that I see this is even in our elementary schools, right? I hear little kids, I go and pick up my kids and they're all all outside. And I hear even after last week and what happened and the way that they talk about it, can you speak to even kind of what that looks like in kid life and as parents, what is it, how do we parent that? How do we help them, have clear picture of who the real hope of the world is, right? Being Jesus Christ.
Yeah. I mean, I'll try. I mean, as an academic and a sociologist, I always want to know, what data do I have to speak to this? So I think a lot of what I'm encouraged by and interested in is religious leaders or faith leaders too, starting to wrestle with this and ask those exact questions.
Yeah.
Because it is a part of discipleship. For adults, but especially on down, and the messages that we have been given and are giving to the next generation. Part of the work, that Sam and I and other colleagues do is just looking at demographic changes in Christianity and religious life in the US and all those things. And there's there has been and there will continue to be a reckoning with young people and the Christian church because of what they see as a disconnect that Sam kind of identified and that, you know, you're talking about, where taught one thing about sacrifice and enemy love and all of those things, and then that we need to put the right people in positions of power and ensure that they take care of us, and it's about taking care of our, you know, desires and needs. That'll continue to happen. But yeah, I think, you know, for young kids, you know, it's probably like with anything. I was watching a Jamar Tisby speak, and so his work on racism in the church, I think, is so helpful and is such a guide for, you know, academics kind of working in these areas. And he was talking about how, you know, talking about race with young kids, it should happen early and often and isn't just one sit down like conversation, but it's an ongoing conversation. Just thinking about, you know, maybe for my fourth grade daughter, looking at the Capitol insurrection, just helping her understand that, you know, these are people that believe that they have the right to do this, but is that, should they be able to? And thinking about that and seeing across, you know, what does that mean? And so, you know, doing it early and often in a continuing conversation. And Jamar Tisby was funny too, because he was saying, you know, it's kind of like the sex talk. It doesn't just happen once, it's in relationship. And so I think with Christian nationalism, which really does overlap a lot with discussing racial inequality and racism within the American church, I think those things are really intertwined. Yeah, it's going to have to be an ongoing conversation. I'm talking with young kids, and I don't have the answers for that, but I'm hopeful that others that are skilled in that will see hopefully this work and know that there's a need here. Yeah. And pastors are saying, you know, we have our congregants for 1 hour on Sundays, but then they're watching, you know, news media for hours every night that are telling them something very different. And so what is discipling them? What is forming them? And so I think all of these conversations will hopefully continue to happen, and experts in those areas will be able to show, you know, at least me or me and Sam the way too on how best to do this.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you. Ongoing conversation. So good.
This podcast is brought to you by Gravity Leadership Academy, our 10-month online training intensive for Christian leaders who want to root their life and leadership in God's love and bring lasting transformation to their culture. In Gravity Leadership Academy, you'll learn the real-life practicalities of how to notice God's presence and activity in and around you so you can participate more fully in God's life and mission and open up space for those around you to do so too. We've worked really hard to make this training in missional leadership practical and doable. To find out more about Gravity Leadership Academy, visit gravityleadership.com/academy.
Yeah, so I hear, just to maybe reset and recap, I hear xenophobia, kind of an us versus them, this desire for power, this desire for real clear boundaries between me and you or us and them. Another thing you talk about in your book is kind of this authoritarianism. What is the appeal of that, and why is that so closely connected to Christian nationalism?
Yeah. So, yeah, in the book, we really follow this outline of Christian nationalism worships at the Holy Trinity, worships the Holy Trinity of power, boundaries, and order. That they value political power and cultural power, that they want clear boundaries between us and them, and they want this kind of, they want to preserve a certain kind of social order that really doesn't necessarily have anything to do with Christianity, but is more about traditional, you know, social roles and divisions and things that they would like to see sanctified and enshrined. Authoritarianism is a means of maintaining that kind of control. And that goes along with the boundaries of who gets the freedom to move about and do what they want and who needs to be controlled. Yeah. And that's where authoritarianism exercises its power. And so one of the things actually, in hindsight, we go into this in the book, but we've collected so much data, done so much exploring, we've seen so much on display in the last year and a half since finishing the book. I don't know if we're ever going to go to paperback, but it would just double the book size because we have so much more evidenced by way of the way Christian nationalism seems to express itself, not only in authoritarianism, but authoritarian violence and justifying authoritarian violence. One of the leading predictors that we see Americans embrace this kind of worldview that sees violence as inevitable and in some ways good is Christian nationalism. So who are going to be the Americans who are most likely to resist any kind of restrictions on gun control? Well, it's the white Christian nationalists that we see. It's who's more likely to be skeptical that police ever cross any boundaries when it comes to appropriate use of force, that they may unlawfully treat or abuse people of color. Christian nationalists up and down deny that. They say it's a media fabrication. That's not going on. Police treat black and white Americans equally. They're pro capital punishment, pro judges cracking down on troublemakers, pro military, right? So all of these kind of indicators of Americans being more of the opinion that, you know what, deviance needs to be controlled, however, by any means possible.
Yeah.
And I think what we saw recently in January 6th, and I'm sure we're gonna talk about this, is a willingness to justify by any means necessary, right? Yeah. Like if I feel like something has gone wrong and somebody has taken what's mine or what's ours or what's rightfully God's, then if I have to take arms, if I have to hurt people, if I have to mob the Capitol, then that's justified. Andrew, did you have anything to add?
Well, yeah, just with what you're saying, you know, something that a colleague and sort of a mentor for us, Phil Gorski, talks about, and we cite this in our book, is with Christian nationalism, they really draw on an Old Testament narrative. And so as Sam's talking about the us versus them and the boundaries and the tribalism, they really draw on this type of maintaining tribal purity and forcefully taking the land, or whether it's real or metaphorical or metaphor, what is the outsiders are holding. And if we have to utilize violence to do that, we can and should. And so you could say the God of the Old Testament, that will sanctify violence and say, use that if you need to, as Sam's talking, that's what, you know, is coming to mind for me too, where, we talk about January 6th, or we look at Trump, last summer, clearing Lafayette Square of protesters with tear gas and police, and then, you know, standing in front of it, just that authoritarianism that I will do what I have to do whatever I want to do, is just part and parcel with this whole cultural framework.
Yeah. Yes. So maybe then turning the focus to January 6th, because we're recording this in between January 6th and in the inauguration. And I know that we're all praying fervently that we don't see a repeat or something worse happen. But I think a lot of Americans were shocked. I was talking to Christy beforehand. Christy, will you share that anecdote just about how surprised or shocked or stunned your family was?
Yeah. Well, I was in class all day. So I was on a Zoom call from like 8 to 5. And so my phone was blowing up. I was getting all these texts, and finally, I finally looked at it and they were like, look at the news. and so I of course read some articles, and my dad had called, and my dad, he's a 75-year-old man, white male. And he said, this is one of the saddest days of my life. And I was like, really? And he put it right up there with divorce and being diagnosed with a disease. And it was, he just could not believe, what was happening. And it's just interesting because you see both sides of people just being like shocked, and then other people saying, we saw signs of this. Mm-hmm.
That's what struck me about that, Christy, is that for your dad, it was like, oh my gosh, where did this come from? And I'm thinking about Andrew and Sam, these two guys I follow on Twitter, and they're like, well, yeah. So I'm wondering, you guys, what did you see on January 6th that maybe confirmed the things that you already knew and fit your data sets? And then anything you saw on January 6th that took you by surprise, or was maybe, as stories emerge, was outside of what your data would suggest about Christian nationalism?
Yeah. I think the way that I was thinking about January 6th is that it was absolutely shocking, but not necessarily surprising. So seeing that happen, it should shock anybody. But I wasn't necessarily surprised that this, you know, as we wrote in our book, and you know, we kind of encouraged each other as we're writing it, like, let's make sure we say what we mean and say what we're going to say, not try to, you know, backpedal or anything. But as I look back, we could have been even more forceful in some of our arguments, especially at the end where we're talking about how with Christian nationalism and seeing the groups that were storming the Capitol and the insurrection, you know, praying before they go in there, or they're entering the doors and they're holding up Bibles or saying in Jesus' name, and they have crosses that they're erecting, you know, and, you know, we see all this symbolism wrapped up in it. And I wouldn't say that they're all just Christian nationalists, but Christian nationalism is a part of this kind of, you know, political theology that makes space for this type of extremism. Hmm. And, you know, it is what was ringing in my head, you know, that we had said and others, is that it's absolutely a threat to a pluralistic democratic society where we share power and we have to compromise. Because if God says that a certain person should sit on the most powerful seat of, you know, of power in the world, the presidency, who is to deny them that? This group believes that God is saying Trump should be president. And so no matter what, even democracy should fall by the wayside for what they believe God wants to see happen. And so, I mean, thank God that it wasn't more violent than it already was. I mean, five people died, but the possibilities of death were so much greater. And so it wasn't surprising, but it was absolutely shocking. And even watching some of the footage come out, you know, one of the war correspondents for the New Yorker, you know, was recording on his phone, watching that yesterday. It's like 12 minutes of footage, but just astounding stuff. But again, we know that Christian nationalism, alongside, you know, other ideologies at play here, really makes space for this type of violent extremism. We have to take it seriously, no matter what, because it is a threat to those institutions and the sharing of power. So that's, you know, some of kind of the broader thoughts I had.
How about you, Sam?
Yeah, you know, it combined a lot of the things that we're observing in surveys on a mass hysteria kind of scale. So like when we're analyzing these surveys, I mean, you can imagine people taking these surveys, right? Like, and so people are doing these surveys and they're at home on their computer, like clicking yes and agree and strongly disagree and all those things, or they're at home, like writing responses to these surveys that we're distributing. They're not in a mob at the time. Right. And so we're observing these really strong correlations and associations between Christian nationalist ideology and the kinds of attitudes and political behaviors that we're seeing. Well, imagine what happens when you get a group of people together who are pissed off, and they're riled up because just this group, this what we sociologists call collective effervescence, right? They're really transcending themselves as individuals at this time in the middle of a mob, like you do at a football game.
Or a rave or something.
Yeah, you just completely lost yourself. And so imagine the things we're observing in Christian nationalism on these surveys, jacked up with this kind of hysteria of Trump being and leading them and rallying them together and them getting worked up, plus this kind of like litany of lies that they have been fed about the corruption of the voting process and all of these things. And so, like Andrew's saying, I mean, it was just unreal to behold. I think he tweeted about like, and that was the first time I thought about this. It's like sitting through 9/11, a kind of situation where this is a historical thing. People are already referring to 1/6, like, you know, this, you know, what were you doing during 1/6 when a mob of people stormed the Capitol? And as videos have been released, progressive, you know, over the last few days, and pictures, and you're just getting stories of the prayer and these kinds of, like, you're getting the quotes. I mean, it just becomes all the more shocking. And, you know, it's just been past 2 weeks have just been living in another time almost. It's just crazy.
Yes. Like a liminal space where, you know, you know, this doesn't happen all the time. I love reading sociological studies, but we've been living in this weird space for a while where the news cycle has been so compressed and like outrageous things happen all the time. And so then I just wonder how much more we can handle, you know, like in our collective character. But maybe Andrew, just to pivot back to your book, one of the things that surprised me was I expected to see a really, really high correlation between the 81%, right? This 81% number of like white evangelicals that voted for Donald Trump and Christian nationalism. But your data actually suggests something different. And I was struck by that because it pressed against some of my biases and prejudices. And I wonder if you could speak to what's wrong with just equating the 81% with Christian nationalism.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one thing that we try to do in the book and that we hope helps some understanding of how evangelicalism, especially, or white evangelicalism, especially, is related to politics in the current moment, is that once we account for Christian nationalism, the differences between evangelicals or white evangelicals and other religious groups and even non-religious people disappear. And so it isn't necessarily evangelicalism in and of itself that is the driving force. It's this cultural framework of Christian nationalism that, granted, is a big part of white evangelicalism. You know, so close to 80% of white evangelicals, you know, are either accommodators or ambassadors, as we talk about in the book, people that are friendly or strongly embracing Christian nationalism. So I think what's helpful is that it helps put the 81% who voted for Trump in perspective. Because when you see evangelicals who reject or resist Christian nationalism, they look much different than their fellow evangelicals do, who strongly embrace it. And so in that sense, Christian nationalism is really helpful to make sense of, you know, who's voting for Trump and why. Because if we have a white Catholic or you know, a mainline Protestant who strongly embraces Christian nationalism, they're going to be much more likely to also vote for Trump and look a lot like evangelicals than embrace Christian nationalism than their fellow co-religionists who reject or resist it.
Yeah. Hey, maybe to wrap up, Sam and Andrew, a lot of our listeners maybe don't identify with some of the things you're talking about as Christian nationalism, but almost every one of us goes to church with somebody who's like this or has a family member, a close family member, a spouse, a kid, mom, a dad who maybe has elements of this. And I've Christy and I talk to people all the time that are beside themselves. Feels like they don't know how to reach them or how to help them. And people are just shouting fake news at each other. What are some things that we can do as Christians who care about the gospel and about faithfulness to Jesus to take some responsibility as white Christians for this Christian nationalism thing? And especially maybe helping loved ones or people we know that are caught up in it.
Yeah. So I think the two diagnostic questions I asked at the beginning are what I often go to in my own kind of thought process of where am I standing in all of this? To what extent am I talking about Christianity, not so much as allegiance to a person, but allegiance to some kind of set of cultural values or morals or ethics that I think other people need to embrace, regardless of whether or not they embrace Jesus, you know, like that I think I don't really care so much if you like or embrace or love or trust Jesus. I just want you to be like me. You know, that should be a red flag, right? Like that should be for any Christian, that should be a problem. What your goal is, I assume, understanding the New Testament would be calling people to follow in discipleship with Jesus. And that involves taking up your cross. That would be another diagnostic, right? Christian nationalism knows no taking up the cross. It rejects the cross as weakness. Yeah. It rejects the cross as losing, right? We don't lose, we win. We're conquerors. And so to what extent is the kind of Christianity that I've embraced one that really needs victory here and now in this life rather than trusting in faith that God is in control and I can be obedient and walk faithfully? I think to what extent asking as a diagnostic, you know, it sounds like you see, I'm imagining a conversation with my relative or friend in my Bible study or whatever. It sounds like you see non-Christians as the enemy, right? Like they're trying to take something that rightfully belongs to you, or they're trying to ruin something that you feel like you own, or whatever, rather than seeing them as people that Jesus died for and loves, and how would you extend service to those people? You know, how do you be Christ to that person? I think, to what extent, I mean, I think I often think about this when I'm thinking about Eric Metaxas, or I'm thinking of some Robert Jeffers, you know, or somebody yeah. who I think is really an ambassador of Christian nationalism, just an archetype of that. I think, you know, how do you see Jesus in what you say and do? Because I feel like the constant verse that I see get quoted by these kinds of folks is Jesus expelling the money changers with whips. That's like the favorite verse, you know, like Jesus getting riled up and beating up people in the market and expelling money changers, but not the Jesus who died for people, not the Jesus who healed, not the Jesus who loved his enemies. And so, yeah. I mean, I like, it sounds cliche to call people back to following Christ, but I think if I can keep Jesus in front and remind them, this is who you serve. This is who you say you want to be like. Don't you see the difference? Don't you see the direction that this has pulled you in? And I think that's what we tried to do with the book, is to try to show, like, look, we're not saying you can't be like, we get this question a lot, and I don't want to go off on a tangent, but we get the question about like, oh, are you saying I can't be a good citizen? I can't be a patriot? And in our minds, there's a difference between patriotism that a Christian is called to, being a good neighbor, loving your neighbors, being a good citizen, honoring the authority and following laws. The earliest Christians were persecuted for being bad citizens. Romans persecuted them and said, you guys are bad citizens because you don't worship the empire or the emperor. And Christians said, no, we're the best citizens. We're the ones you want in your city. We should be that. And yet we shouldn't be storming the Capitol to come for Pence's head and Pelosi's head. I mean, how scary. But I think, so just to bring it back, I think calling people to really follow Christ in a sincere way, the Christ of the Gospels, not the Christ of the Christ of two verses and expelling the money changers from the temple.
Yeah.
So good.
That is so good. Andrew, what would you add?
Well, I think Sam really kind of identified a lot of what we think and feel. And I think just, you know, coming out of, or, you know, being in and growing up around white evangelicalism, and being warned of, you know, the philosophies of this world and being careful to not be taken away, I think we really have to realize that within this tradition, Christian nationalism was so pernicious because it seemed so close to what we thought Christianity was. And so, you know, at the beginning of the book, we quote Colossians 2:8, where, you know, Paul's telling them not to be taken away by worldly philosophies that depend on human tradition. And you know, I think a lot of that is power. Is it power over other people, or is it power through service and giving up your life and dying? And that, I think, you know, as Sam talked about so well, is power over other people. That's an affront to the gospel. And that isn't, you know, what Jesus did to show the way. And so those are things that I continually think about, or for me, try to keep in mind when wrestling with Christian nationalism versus, as Sam said, a Christianity that should, you know, be a blessing to the social space and to our civic culture, not necessarily that we dominate it, but that we infuse it with love and you know, brotherly and sisterly love. So,
yeah, Christy, what did you hear there? What struck you in that response?
Well, you know, actually, as both of them are talking, you know, we talk a lot with Gravity Leadership about grace and truth, and I see that here. Like asking questions to the person who you're like, I see a little bit of this. Is this how you're seeing? Are you seeing them as enemies? You're not seeing them as people, you know, that type of thing. And what does it look like to be Jesus, the real Jesus, the Jesus of the gospel, to everyone around us in our communities, in our, you know, in our neighborhoods, it's in our world.
Yeah. Well, Andrew and Sam, thanks for spending time with us today. You guys are both on Twitter. I know, where else, is there anywhere else people can interact with you online? We'll put your Twitter handles in the bio. Anything else we should know about how to maybe read what you're doing or interact with you?
Just Twitter.
Yeah, just Twitter. Twitter, I think, is the best way that we kind of keep the Christian nationalism research coming. So,
well, who knows what's trending now? We've been off Twitter for 40 minutes.
Right.
So, hey, both of you, thanks for the work you're doing. And I just want to commend this book, Taking Back America for God. It's not just a slamming on white Christians, but really your love for Jesus and for the gospel and for actually having a faithful witness to the gospel, I think comes through in every chapter of this book. And so thanks for making data so enjoyable.
Yes.
That's relevant. That's great. Relevant.
That is.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Our show is produced by Ben Sternke, Matt Tebby, and Ben Hardman. Aaron Sternke does our mixing and mastering. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com. If you find our podcast helpful, share it with your friends in person and on social media. And don't forget to rate and review us online, as well as subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can join our Gravity community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join. And hey, we'd love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment, send us an idea, a recommendation, recipe, whatever. You can email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.